picture there is not related, but it's a young woman phoning her housing officer to see if there's somewhere for her to sleep. Underline these things. Underline the kind of mess of housing that we're in. Are other trends, and the big trend has been, at least, and I'm now going to talk, I'm afraid, exclusively, I think, about England for the rest of the 5 minutes of this, rising income inequality. If you have the rich and the top 10% getting better off, and the middle dropping slightly and the bottom dropping more, you're going to end up with a very polarised situation in housing. You're going to end with fewer people able in a situation to get out a mortgage. And in one way, we're seeing the repercussions of that rise in income inequality that began in 1978, 1979. It takes some time for it to work through. You can't have a well-housed population when you're progressively dividing people by how much money they have. This graph was produced by Oxfam. At the extremes, we are seeing the biggest rises in the cost of property in the heart of London. It's not just the borough of Kensington and Chelsea, where a two-bed flat will now cost you over £1 million. It's rippled right across the capital and out into the southeast of England. This is a map from The Guardian showing particular, or stereotyping particular groups of people coming in from abroad. Supposedly buying housing as a kind of safe investment. But much of the buying is by people inside the country, thinking it's safe to spend an enormous amount of money, or borrow an enormous amount of money to buy a house because the prices are going up here. The effects of this have become so extreme that although the overall population of London has gone up a lot in the last 10 years, the number of people in Kensington and Chelsea has actually gone down. More housing is empty in the heart of London. It's rather like a volcano while the prices go up and up. But think about your economics. Actual number of people needing to be housed is going down, the prices are going up. At some point it has to burst. At some point it becomes ridiculous and unsustainable. But while things like gold go down in value and other things go down in value, you can see the very rich is thinking that this may be a safe place for money. But it makes it harder and harder to be well housed in a city like London. I like some of the Oxfam simplest graphs, and this is one of the simplest ones. It's showing who's going to be most affected by those cuts that have already been announced to happen and those which are to happen in the UK up to 2016. And that kind of distribution, I think, almost encourages the bubble to continue. It encourages those prices at the top, where the majority of people who are well paid live in England, to continue up until the point when they burst. All bubbles do eventually burst. I've just got three more slides and then I'll stop. I'm going to make some suggestions. Suggestions, I think, have to be very place specific nowadays. You can't make general suggestions over what you do, other than to say that we really need to think of housing again as a source of shelter, as the way in which we receive our shelter and feel safe about where we are, and not as a source of investment or a pension or something that can be used for profit, but as a source of shelter. The biggest difference between the 1930s and now is that we have enough housing. In the 1930s, we still had rookeries. We still had people living in absolutely appalling conditions above ground. We have enough housing now, almost everywhere in the rich world, even in London. In London, there are more bedrooms than there are people. We counted bedrooms at the last census. There are more bedrooms than there are people. Even if nobody wanted to sleep in the same bed as anybody else in London, everybody could have a bed. In England, there are two bedrooms for every person in England. So it's not a lack of housing. And this is where I differ from a lot of my colleagues who say we really need to build more housing. I think we do need to build more housing if more people keep on coming. And that's been another effect of the crisis in the southeast of England because of the English language. But But we don't need to build more housing for the people who are here. We need to renovate it and share it out better. And we certainly need less empty housing. My preference for how this would be done in England is to pay homage to the inventor of the council tax. The council tax came in when the poll tax failed. The council tax had bands of A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. They left the rest of the alphabet out. This is great because you can just add council tax bands relatively easily. You only have to go at the N at the moment and you get to the most expensive mansion if you double them every time. So you've still got the rest of the letters. But it wouldn't be impossible in a crisis situation, say a triple dip recession with no signs of things getting better, to adapt the council tax system and in effect include a mansion tax and be taxing people on the value, the worth of their land and their housing. This would have very little effect on 95% of the population. A small effect on the 4% above the 95% and would only hurt the 1%. But within the 1%, it would hurt those at the top most and those at the bottom of the 1% least. The 1% are the most divided group within British society. And I'm very interested in what's happening here over that. It's claimed in England that it's almost impossible to register property, that we can't actually work out who owns what if they haven't sold it in the last 15 years. The faster that Ireland registers its property, the more the lie to that statement is put for England. I think land value taxation is the most important long-term solution to this problem, to discourage people from holding housing they do not need and holding land empty that they do not need, and to reduce taxes on people whose use of housing is very, very little. I'll go through a few other suggestions. In all four countries of the United Kingdom, we have different versions of what I call the right to sell. They were introduced by the Labour government, but hardly taken up at all. About 600 households, I think, have come up in England. And this is the right, when you can't pay your mortgage anymore, to stay in your house but become a tenant. And in effect, to sell your house to a housing association rather than be evicted. And I think if you look at the mass evictions that are taking place in the United States, damage that is done from this is massive. The right to sell to mirror the right to buy so that hard-working families with children can stay in their house, I think, could be popular. We need to do something about second homes, holiday homes, empty commercial property and so on to discourage waste. The main policy that has been enacted since, I think it's the 6th of April, so not very long so far, has been a tax on bedrooms of people in social housing in England. The tax is being levied on that part of the housing system which is most efficient. People are most closely housed. It's the housing of the right sizes in the social housing sector. But it's an unnecessary tax. It will not have the effect it needs to have. And as I said before, we have enough rooms. There are enough rooms for households to have a spare room, just not for people to be living in a house with 6 bedrooms, rattling around on their own, or to own a second or a third home. I'm not saying nobody should have a second or third home, but they should pay enough tax if they do to really represent how much they really value doing that. I said before, the building of new housing is really only necessary, even in a place as crowded as the southeast of England, if more people come in who need to be housed. We could do an awful lot more of knocking 2 homes into one, 2 small terraces into one. Those kind of adaptations are much more sensible than new build. There's a much more fundamental problem, which is this growing inequality in societies between the rich and the poor. And ultimately, that's only addressed if benefits actually do rise faster than wages at the bottom. Otherwise, you're always going to have a group who are going to find things incredibly difficult. And wages need to rise faster. Weekly pay, people are on a pay packet a week, need to raise a little bit faster than salaries. Salaries need to go up more than house prices. Salaries can drop as long as house prices drop, just not as much as house prices. And rents need to stay still if not fall. And I know this is different in different places, The average rents in England are twice what you'd pay a mortgage for. The people are very angry about the rents. Where rents are high, you need to control rents again. Rather than saying that people's housing benefits will be stopped and they'll be evicted unless the landlord can find somebody who can pay the rent, we do need to think about bringing rent controls in again. Cities like Vienna have rent controls. Rent controls were a normal thing in much of Europe. And in a time of crisis, when you really want to make sure that the population, they can't have holidays, they can only have one car, you might not all be able to get a job if you want to get a job, but you should at least be able to eat a decent amount of food and expect to be housed. There are certain minimums that need to be guaranteed in some of the richest countries in the world. A very English thing next, squatting's been criminalised again recently in England. Squatting, I think, should go back to its status. If your people are not squatting for gain, but squatting because it's the only way they can get themselves housed anywhere where there's a chance of getting a job, it shouldn't be a criminal offence. And similarly, the criminal offences of landlords, who are now renting out garden sheds across the whole of London illegally to people in substandard situations, you're only going to stop people behaving in that way if you make it a criminal offence to do something like that rather than a civil offence. It's obviously a big wish and a relevant thing, but when you're in a crisis like this, you need to think about how you change things fundamentally, because the way we were before was not working. And lastly, the last of my 10, I think this gets back to the not necessarily building very much. Housing is all about the long term. Housing lives for longer than people. Most housing lives for at least 150 years. If you do it up and look after the housing stock, you can make it live for 200, 250 years in an area without earthquakes. Your housing policy is a long-term policy, not a short-term fix. And my final slide shows you part of that long-term policy. That housing was never built to house the woman who's pushing the pram across there now. But it was built and provided in such a way that it is housing a completely different set of people in that street in Sheffield to the ones that the steel factory bosses wanted to be housed there. Housing is fundamental at the bottom of this crisis. Housing is the basic thing that one of the basic things that everybody needs. And policies that work out a way to guarantee we can't make you all rich, we can't give you a kind of dream that you're going to be living like millionaires, but we can say that you will all be decently housed, given that we've already got the stock built everywhere. I don't understand why it isn't possible to move towards these kind of policies unless you're trying to protect the equity interests of a very small proportion of people who happen to own quite a lot of very expensive housing. Thank you very much.
To such a thought-provoking presentation and discourse that we've had from Professor Glorley. I think we could probably say we recognise virtually everything, if not everything, that you've mentioned there. From the rise in, from our Celtic Tiger days when we couldn't build big enough houses, to the current situation when we have empty estates, ghost estates, which you may have seen about around Ireland. Some of the things that you said in terms of the housing stock, there being enough bedrooms, possibly there are enough bedrooms in Ireland also. The problem in Ireland at the moment is that many of those bedrooms are in the wrong places. And I know from looking at your website, which I, as my children advised me, asked Google when I was asked to do this, I had a look at the website, which is really fascinating. that Professor Dorling is a very good geographer and uses that the whole mapping technique to put a real context on it. And so you can see the United Kingdom in particular, but also the rest of the world in a different way, where the maps are where the people are, as opposed to the physical structure. It's very interesting to look at it like that. I'd like to see that done for Ireland as well. But if you start to look at the Irish situation, you see that there are many housing estates around the country, but they're not in the places where people have jobs. And people, while there is a school of thought that thinks that homeless people or people who need housing ought to be housed in those places, in those housing estates, it's a good theory, but when it comes to it, it's not very practical if there isn't employment around there. Now the answer is not, I don't think, tear down the houses. It's try to provide employment in local areas. I'm not sure that the London analogy is absolutely the same with Ireland, but I think many of the broader pieces that you set across your discourse, I think have a resonance with most people here. There is some of this type of work done, as I'm sure you're aware, in the university in Maynooth by NIRSA. And it is that kind of analysis. Statistics are very flat if somebody doesn't analyse them. And I think the kind of analysis that Professor Dorling has brought us in terms of actually analysing census data and putting almost stories around it is extremely useful. And I recognise it in terms of some of the work that's done out of the project in the Maynooth. And from a planning perspective, I work in the planning area at the moment. From a planning perspective, I think one of the things that I'm seeing from this is how important planning is, and planning for people to live in houses. Planning around people's lives, a house, as you say, is the most essential thing. And I think particularly in the Irish context, where I suppose eviction has a very historic connotation for all of us, and it's not something that anybody ever wants to see happen in Ireland again, that it is such an emotive issue. A house is somebody's home and not an asset. And I think we lost track of that totally during the Celtic Tiger days. I think we could also probably look at what you said about some various people and their quotes about numerous houses and the numbers of houses they have. And I think most of us who were watching the Late Late Show on the famous night when a particular minister said in a very offhand way how difficult it was to keep up two houses. He sort of got his comeuppance later from the Irish people for, I suppose, arrogance in that particular way of saying it. So I think that an awful lot of things of what you've said there resonate with me, and I think with others in the room. It's given us a huge food for thought in terms of how to maybe begin to assess the housing stock that is there and what we can do with it, but also how we can bring employment and enterprise to the areas where the houses are. But it is most important that people are housed and that they're not threatened. The other resonance that we have, I think, in a very sad way, is with suicide and with that deep sense of foreboding that people have at a political level as well. President Higgins made a very important speech the other week, setting that out at a more of a European international scale. The foreboding that people have and the disconnect with what's going on. People can't understand how things have got to such a bad point. They can't see a way forward out of it. And it's really very difficult to ask them to engage with all of the various things that are going on. However, we have to go on with it. And it is part of the planning process is really vested in our local authorities, our planning authorities, in terms of trying to design for the future. and to ensure that development is plan-led, that it's not speculative. I think we've seen enough of that. And that we actually build, plan first of all, and build what we plan, and plan to have people working in the places where they are living. I think that's probably about the most important thing in terms of spatial planning, that people can live in comfort and without the foreboding. I think it's terribly sad that we've got to this position. And also, I think we can all relate, although it is quite shocking to see what you said about the elderly being, you know, when you said a health impact, I was thinking of all different things. I didn't think for a second that it was in the elderly population. That is really very sad when we see it like that. So I won't say very much more because I'm sure people would like to ask you questions, but I'd like to thank you for a very interesting elaboration of the housing and we look forward to seeing your book when it comes out. But I would encourage people to look at the website, and it isn't really that much about housing, but it's a lot about inequality and a lot of things I think that we could take to heart and maybe apply to our own systems here in terms of a fairer society and a better society to live in.